Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The Somali government declares a drought, and President Obama says evidence shows a Malaysian plane was shot down. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The Somali government has officially declared a drought in six regions as monitors warn that food prices are soaring in the affected areas. The government on Thursday established a $500,000 drought relief fund and renewed an appeal for international help to combat growing food shortages and water. The Somali Agriculture Minister tells VOA's Somali service that officials want to prevent a repeat of the famine 3 years ago that killed more than 200,000 Somalis and forced hundreds of thousands more to flee to neighboring Kenya and Ethiopia. South Africans are marking the first Nelson Mandela Day since the anti-apartheid icon's death by performing acts of kindness. Organizers urge the former president's supporters to spend 67 minutes helping others today to mark Mr. Mandela's 67 years of public service. Some people have volunteered in orphanages, while others have distributed handmade blankets to the less fortunate. Friday would have been Mr. Mandela's 96th birthday. U.S. President Barack Obama says the deaths of 298 people aboard the Malaysian Airlines plane that went down over eastern Ukraine are an outrage of unspeakable proportions. Speaking at the White House today, Mr. Obama said evidence indicates the plane was shot down by surface-to-air missiles launched from an area controlled by Russian-backed separatists.
It is not possible for these separatists to function the way they're functioning. To have the equipment that they have. Set aside what's happened with respect to the Malaysian Airlines, a group of separatists can't shoot down military transport planes, or they claim shoot down fighter jets without sophisticated equipment and sophisticated training, and that is coming from Russia.
The president went on to call for an international investigation into the incident, saying Russia and the separatists must adhere to an immediate ceasefire. Meanwhile, the international medical community is mourning those sudden deaths of as many as 100 AIDS researchers and experts who were headed to a high-level AIDS conference in Australia. They were among the 298 passengers aboard a Malaysian Airlines flight that crashed. The Australian Prime Minister has blamed pro-Russian forces for shooting down the flight. Anita Powell reports.
Many of those on board the flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur were respected AIDS researchers and activists, headed to a major AIDS conference that begins Monday in Melbourne, Australia. Those losses will likely compound an already tragic event by robbing the broader struggle against HIV and AIDS of some of its leading researchers. The International AIDS Society said in a Friday statement that they are still seeking details on how the crash will affect their conference. But they added, in recognition of their colleagues' great dedication to fighting this deadly epidemic, the conference will go on as planned. Anita Powell, VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. President Barack Obama says he told Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that no nation should accept rockets being fired into its borders as Israeli troops backed by tanks, aircraft, and Navy ships continue to advance into the Gaza Strip. Speaking at the White House today, the president told reporters he made clear during a phone conversation with Mr. Netanyahu that the understanding is that the ground operation will destroy tunnels that Hamas militants are using to attack Israel. Meanwhile, Palestinian medics say at least 25 Gaza residents have died since the start of the ground offensive. A powerful storm that killed dozens in the Philippines have strengthened into a super typhoon before hitting southern China this afternoon. Chinese meteorology officials say Typhoon Ramasun has hit the southern Chinese island of Hainan on its way to the province of Guangdong. North Korea is threatening to pull its delegation out of the Asian Games scheduled for later this year in South Korea after talks on the North's involvement broke down this week. The state-run Korean Central News Agency says South Korean officials made a series of absurd demands at the talks that were held Thursday on the border village of Panjuan. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have raided a farming town in northeastern Nigeria, killing dozens of people and burning homes. Locals say parts of the region have been cut off from the government and militants control the roads.
That's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also in the news, U.S. President Barack Obama says evidence indicates the Malaysia Airlines plane that crashed in eastern Ukraine yesterday was shot down from an area controlled by pro-Russian separatists. And gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have raided a farming town in northeastern Nigeria.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Peter Clotie sitting in for Sunny, music from the Ivory Coast, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, U.S. President Barack Obama says evidence indicates the Malaysia Airlines plane that crashed in eastern Ukraine yesterday was shot down by a surface-to-air missile launched from an area controlled by pro-Russian separatists. Speaking at the White House today, President Obama called the deaths of the 298 people aboard the plane an outrage of unspeakable proportions. He noted that at least one American was among the dead. Mr. Obama called for an international investigation into the incident, saying Russia, the separatists, and Ukraine must adhere to an immediate ceasefire. He said the tragedy underscores it is time for peace and security to be restored in Ukraine. Malaysia Airlines Flight M17 was on its way from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur at the time of the apparent missile strike. At an emergency United Nations Security Council meeting today, the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, noted it is unlikely that the separatists could operate the missile system without assistance from knowledgeable personnel. She said technical assistance from Russia cannot be ruled out.
It's estimated that as many as 100 of the passengers who died in the Malaysian plane crash were heading for the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. We have the identities of two of them at this time. Glenn Thomas was a former BBC journalist and longtime communications officer for the World Health Organization. His sister released a statement saying Thomas died doing what he loved. Another of the victims was AIDS expert Joop Lang, former president of the International AIDS Society. A close friend said Lang's death was a great loss to the world in the fight against AIDS and a great loss to the Netherlands. UNAIDS says there were many delegates to the AIDS 2014 conference on board flight MH17, including scientists, researchers, and medical doctors.
Eight minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have raided a farming town in northeastern Nigeria, killing dozens of people and burning homes. Locals say parts of the region have been cut off from the government and militants control the roads. Heather Murdoch has more for VOA from Abuja.
Residents say gunmen stormed the remote town of Damboa in southern Borno State around 5 a.m. Friday. The attack was one of several in the area over the past 2 weeks. Witnesses say by the time this one was over, half the buildings left standing after the last attack were burned down. Bodies lay scattered in the streets to be picked up by civilian volunteer teams. The townspeople had little chance against the militants. Residents say security forces abandoned the town weeks ago after Boko Haram attacked a military outpost, killing soldiers and police officers. Some villagers say their only weapons are sticks and locally made obsolete Dane guns. Despite continued near-daily attacks, the Nigerian government says recent agreements made with neighboring countries will help end the five-year-old Boko Haram insurgency. Doyin Akupe is the senior special assistant on public affairs to President Goodluck Jonathan.
We have what it takes. We have the military might. We have the resources. We have the men, and we have the will. And luckily for us, now that we have gotten cooperation with our neighbors, you know, in terms of intelligence and, you know, support, we will win this war.
Akupe says security forces are also doing everything in their power to rescue more than 200 girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram more than 3 months ago. The failure to rescue the girls or stop the relentless Boko Haram attacks has sparked strong criticism of President Jonathan's government. This week, the Nigerian president asked lawmakers to approve a $1 billion request for foreign loans to upgrade military equipment. Human Rights Watch says Boko Haram killed more than 2,000 civilians in the first 6 months of this year alone, the majority of them in Borno State. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has to wait about 2 months before the National Assembly considers his request for a $1 billion loan for the military. Both houses have adjourned for the annual summer recess and will not act on the request until sometime in September. Mr. Jonathan says he wants the money to boost Nigeria's military so it can better tackle the Boko Haram militant group in the north. Meanwhile, violence continues with kidnappings and killings. Thousands of civilians, Muslim and Christian, have died in Boko Haram attacks.
Gabon has released 100 of an estimated 500 Cameroonian, Chadian, and Central African illegal immigrants detained for 10 months for unlawful mining. Some of the freed people say they were simple refugees from the CAR. Reporter Moki Edwin Kinzika talked with them in Cameroon's border town of Kiosi and has this report.
30 of the migrants flushed out of Gabon look tired, hungry, and sick. 24-year-old Ibrahim Alaman, who says he left his native Chad to look for a job in Gabon, tells VOA that he spent a month in the dispensary of the prison in Libreville, but was not treated for rashes all over his body. He says there was no medical assistance in the prison and is calling on those who can to help him and other refugees who are still detained in Gabon. Imran Zuli, a refugee from the Central African Republic, says he and those with him were arrested during a raid organized by Gabonese authorities. He says that after being abused by the police, they were transferred to the town of Oyem, where they spent 3 days before returning to Bitam to be judged.
Je ne sais pas pourquoi on m'a arrêté. J'ai fait 10 mois de prison.
He says he does not know why he was arrested and imprisoned for 10 months when Gabonese authorities know that in the CAR there is war, there is insecurity, and it is very difficult to leave. Zuli adds that the rights of the migrants were never respected in prison.
On a souffert, je vous assure, on a vraiment souffert. En prison là-bas, c'était très difficile.
He says they really suffered and prison conditions in Gabon are horrible. According to the ex-prisoners, the police raids targeted people illegally residing in Gabon. A total of 500 individuals from African countries, including Mali and Benin, were arrested. 18-year-old Linda Kumani, who is also from the CAR, says she had asked for asylum after fleeing the carnage in her country, but the Gabon police did not take that into consideration.
I'm a refugee from Central Africa, and I seek asylum in Gabon, but they have arrested me for 7 months and maltreating me there. I don't understand why they maltreat me here while I was still suffering in my country, Central Africa.
Among the ex-prisoners arriving here in Kiosi were 24 Cameroonians. 34-year-old Leonard Kibi told VOA that seven of them were too sick to return to Kiosi.
By the grace of God that we are alive, the poor have maltreated us enough even to eat rice every day during these 8 months we have spent there. They even refuse to give us tablets.
The governor of Cameroon's South Region, Jules Marcelin Jaga, told VOA that Cameroonians should avoid traveling to Gabon without their official documents.
They have a very beautiful country. They have to stay here in their country. And if one day they go out, they have to respect the law and regulation in force in that country.
Equatorial Guinea also recently expelled hundreds of Cameroonians for failing to produce residence permits. The move has been interpreted as a violation of the terms governing the movement of goods and people in the Central African Economic and Monetary Community, CEMAC. Cameroon, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, Central African Republic, Chad and Congo-Brazzaville are members of the bloc. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Kiosi, Cameroon.
The Somali government has officially declared a drought in six regions. Monitors warn that food prices are soaring in the affected areas. The government yesterday established a $500,000 drought relief fund and renewed an appeal for international help to combat growing shortages of food and water. Somali Agricultural Minister Abdi Ahmed Mohamed tells VOA that officials want to prevent a repeat of the famine 3 years ago that killed more than 200,000 Somalis and forced hundreds of thousands more to flee to neighboring Kenya and Ethiopia. The Famine Early Warning System Network warned today that food prices are rising rapidly in several areas. The network blames the situation mainly on inter-clan fighting and efforts by Al-Shabaab militants to cut off towns under government control. It says that in one part of the Bakool region, the price of the staple food red sorghum was 142% higher in June compared to 1 year earlier.
The 19-year-old son of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi was picked up by Cairo police today while boarding a train for Upper Egypt. Abdullah Morsi and a friend were arrested last March for possession of two hashish joints. They were released the next day after agreeing to provide urine samples for a drug test. The prosecutor says they tested positive for the drug. 2 weeks ago, they were sentenced to a year in prison and fined $1,400. However, Mr. Morsi's son was not present for the sentencing. Morsi's lawyer calls the charges a fabrication. Morsi's father was ousted from office and faces treason charges. More than 1,500 others who supporters have also been detained. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. President Barack Obama says evidence indicates the Malaysia Airlines plane that crashed in eastern Ukraine yesterday was shot down from an area controlled by pro-Russian forces. And gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have raided a farming town in northeastern Nigeria. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The UN High-Level Commission on Ending Childhood Obesity has begun work on ways to tackle the global epidemic of obesity among children. The commission, established by World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan, is composed of 15 experts who will focus on prevention and seek to reverse the growing crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports the number of overweight or obese infants and children has increased from 31 million globally in 1990 to 44 million in 2012. Over the same period, it says the number of obese children in Africa alone has risen from 4 to 10 million. If current trends continue, WHO warns there will be 70 million obese children in the world by 2025. Co-chair of the Commission on Ending Childhood Obesity, Peter David Gluckman, is chief science advisor to New Zealand's prime minister. He says obese children will grow up to become obese adults who will suffer from diabetes, heart disease, high rates of cancer, and other health problems. He says people have to understand that children are not little adults. Therefore, he says tackling obesity among this group will involve a strategy different from that employed among adults. He tells VOA there are two main ways ways of intervening in childhood obesity.
And they're not mutually exclusive. They go together. It's about optimizing the health of mothers before that, women and girls before they get pregnant, optimizing the conditions of pregnancy, promoting good breastfeeding and weaning behaviors, much of which has been lost, particularly in Western countries. At the same time, you've got to worry about the obesogenic environment, reinforce making sure that, you know, that there are a number of things you can do to promote healthy eating and diet in young people.
At one time, communicable or infectious diseases were considered the major threat in developing countries. But now, non-communicable diseases such as heart disease and stroke, diabetes and cancer are emerging as major challenges. They are linked to four lifestyle risk factors, including tobacco use, unhealthy diet, little physical activity, and the harmful use of alcohol. Dr. Gluckman says all these factors contribute to the growing obesity crisis. He says what happens in early life determines what happens later in life. He notes there is a huge problem of obesity in the Pacific Islands and the Caribbean. He says there is a large epidemic of childhood obesity in the Middle East, and countries in sub-Saharan Africa also are at risk.
Countries like Nigeria, Ghana, and so forth, we're seeing the coexistence of malnutrition on one hand with obesity on the other hand, and we're seeing numbers that are really quite astounding, particularly in the urban environment, of children now living in environments where there's a larger use of cooking oil, of fried foods and so forth. It's changing quite rapidly.
The 15-member commission is composed of social scientists, public health specialists, clinical scientists, and economists. It will examine evidence on prevention of childhood obesity and how to reverse it in overweight children. The members will work out a monitoring scheme to see whether their efforts to turn the epidemic around are bearing fruit. The commission will deliver its report to the WHO Director General next year. The World Health Assembly in May will subsequently discuss the recommendations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report says investment in HIV/AIDS prevention research fell by $50 million last year to under $1.3 billion. Most of that is due to a drop in U.S. and European investments. The report was released prior to next week's opening of the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne. The report comes from the HIV Vaccines and Microbicides Resource Tracking Group. It's jointly published by UNAIDS, AVAC, and the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, also known as IAVI. Margie McLichlin is president and CEO of IAVI. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the decrease in spending.
When we looked at spending for HIV prevention research, we saw a decline of about 4% or $50 million from 2012 to 2013. And we also saw about a 3.5% decline specifically for HIV vaccine research.
How much of a blow was that to research?
It is certainly a blow when you're not able to sustain funding for your research programs. And in fact, as you move along in a product development cycle, you would expect to spend more over time because, in particular, for HIV vaccines, we now have some promising candidates being designed based upon some of the tremendous discoveries in areas such as broadly neutralizing antibodies. So my experience, having spent 26 years in the pharmaceutical industry and having run Merck's global vaccine business, is that when you reach this point where you have promising candidates, you then accelerate your spending as it costs more as you proceed through subsequent stages of research. So at a time when we have the most promising discoveries that we've had in the field for years and we should be investing more, we actually are cutting back on our investments.
Now, much of this was due to the sequestration, I believe, when Congress and the President could not reach agreement on a budget deal and the automatic cuts went through. Is that correct?
Yes, sequestration was the one factor that led to the greatest dollar decline year to year. But let me also say that the U.S. government is the most significant supporter of HIV vaccine and HIV prevention research. They account for about 70% of spending. So yes, we were hit because of this across-the-board sequestration. But the more important point is that we really need other nations of the world to step up their investment. And in particular, I would cite Europe, where we have seen a decline in funding of about 15% over the last couple of years. And so we really need to motivate other governments to do their part and to step up in a big way like the U.S. government has done.
Now, the decline in Europe comes at a time when HIV prevalence is on the rise in Eastern Europe, right?
That's absolutely correct. We are seeing increasing rates of HIV in Eastern Europe. And the decline in Europe was certainly, you know, along with the economic recession that we know hit some European governments particularly hard. So now that we do see Europe coming out of the recession and we do see renewed growth in some countries, we really are hoping that Europe steps up its funding and helps us to rid the world of this devastating pandemic.
So how does HIV prevention research funding look this year?
It's too hard to say at a global level. I can tell you for our organization, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, we are relatively stable from 2013 to 2014. That's a positive sign for us. But as I said, being stable isn't good enough as we have these promising discoveries and we're moving to subsequent stages of research. We need to achieve increased funding.
How much of an increase?
Well, that's always the big question, isn't it? What will it take to get to market? But I know we've looked at this within our organization alone, and we believe if we had about 15 to 20% greater funding, we're funded at about $60 million a year, then we could get to proof of concept faster. And I think once we get to proof of concept for a vaccine candidate, we will have pharmaceutical companies willing to make the investment to go into phase three and to bring these vaccines for market.
Wasn't there proof of concept, though, a number of years ago with the Thailand study?
Well, there was partial proof of concept. We were all very excited by the fact that for the first time ever, we showed that an AIDS vaccine can decrease the incidence of AIDS. But it was only about 30%, and we believe that we need a longer duration. The efficacy waned over time. The protection waned over time. So what that trial has given us is greater confidence that if we can make the investments and move forward, both with improvements upon that vaccine candidate itself, which is underway, and there will be an efficacy trial started in South Africa, which is targeted to begin in 2016. But we also are looking at other candidates, such as those based upon the discoveries in broadly neutralizing antibodies, that may give us a vaccine that is globally effective, because there are different clades or different types of the virus because of the tremendous mutation that takes place. So even if the candidate works in South Africa, it may not be applicable to other parts of the world which have different type of HIV virus. So continued innovation is critical in order to assure that we have a globally effective vaccine.
Margie Maglin is president and CEO of IAV. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Well, today is Nelson Mandela Day. It is the first time the day will be observed since the death of the South African leader last December at the age of 95. In November 2009, the United Nations declared July 18th, Mr. Mandela's birthday, as Nelson Mandela Day. Since then, millions of people around the world have marked the day by volunteering 67 minutes of their time, 1 minute for every year of Mr. Mandela's struggle for equality, to do charitable work. South African President Jacob Zuma has called on his country's citizens to honor Mr. Mandela this year by cleaning up their surroundings. He said that working together to build their beautiful country is what Mr. Mandela taught South Africans to do.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Leaders around the world call for an investigation into the crash of the Boeing 777, which was headed from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur when it went down. The Somali government has officially declared a drought in six regions. And gunmen believed to be Boko Haram militants have raided a farming town in northeastern Nigeria, killing dozens of people and burning up homes. Coming up, we have music from Ivory Coast, and in our feature segment, we're going to hear about a major star of Soukous music, the Congolese pop music rooted in the rumba. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports. We have Peter Cloete sitting in today for the vacationing Sonny Young. Happy Friday, Peter.
Happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Peter, I understand you have some really big news in soccer for us today.
Yes, I do.
All righty, let's hear it.
Thank you very much, Kim. Well, German captain Philipp Lahm stunned his homeland on Friday by quitting international football just days after leading his side to World Cup victory in Brazil. The 30-year-old Bayern Munich defender, who can also play in midfield, played 113 times for Germany. Lahm will continue playing for his club side, where he renewed his contract until 2018, shortly before the World Cup. Lahm's international career started in February 2004 with a 2-1 defeat of Croatia and ended with a 1-0 win of Argentina in the World Cup final on Sunday. Lahm now plans to focus on the club side that he joined age 11 and has been captain of since 2011. Ivory Coast Yaya Toure says he has no intention whatsoever of leaving Premier League champions Manchester City and is looking forward to the new season with them. Media reports linked the midfielder with a number of clubs since his agent Dimitri Selick tweeted in May that he was unsettled. Selick claimed that the Ivorian was not given proper recognition by the club on his birthday during a close season trip to Abu Dhabi, comment subsequently supported by Toure on Twitter. Toure, who signed a new 4-year contract with City last year, was due for talks with City over his future before the club's second match of their summer tour of the United States on July 27. Newcastle United paid tribute on Friday to two lifelong supporters who were killed in the Malaysian Airlines crash on Thursday while on their way to watch the club's pre-season tour of New Zealand. John Adler, thought to be in his 60s, and Liam Sweeney, 28, were on the passenger list for flight MH17. The pair were known to club officials as regulars at away matches, where among 295 people on the flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur that was brought down over eastern Ukraine. The club will be dedicating an area surrounding the statue to former manager Sir Bobby Robson at their St. James's Park Stadium for fans to pay their respect to the two men. There will be an official tribute to them at the opening Premier League game against champions Manchester City on Sunday, August 17, and Newcastle players will wear black armbands for their games against Sydney FC and Wellington Phoenix in New Zealand. Turkish club Besiktas has announced the signing of Senegal's Chelsea striker Dembaba after a move was completed. Besiktas claimed the deal for the 29-year-old Senegal striker is worth over $8 million. Ba passed a medical on Friday after posting a picture of himself wearing a Besiktas shirt. Ba is likely to join Besiktas at their pre-season training camp in England. The former Newcastle forward only started 23 of his 51 appearances for the Blues, scoring 14 goals as he found himself third choice behind Samuel Eto'o and Fernando Torres. And European Football Association, or UEFA, has changed the rules on yellow cards. The rule change will make it harder for players to be suspended for the Champions League and Europa League finals. UEFA acted on the recommendation of a panel set up by its competitions committee. The group decided that yellow cards accrued will be wiped out after the quarterfinal stage. Real Madrid's Xabi Alonso missed last season's Champions League final after picking up a third yellow card at the semi-final stage against Bayern Munich. The rule was first implemented at Euro 2012 in Ukraine and Poland, but this is the first time it had been implemented in major European club contests. Moving to Africa, Cameroon's President Paul Biya has ordered the country's prime minister to launch an investigation into the poor showing of the senior national team, the Indomitable Lions, at the World Cup in Brazil. Some of the players were attacked by sports fans after accusing the players of lack of patriotism and disgraceful conduct. Nana Walter Wilson is sports editor of the Post newspaper in Cameroon. He tells me that the president's inquiry call appears not to be sitting well with some of the same fans who were displeased with the performance of the Indomitable Lions at the World Cup.
The public in Cameroon and the media in Cameroon, they received the presidential instructions that the Prime Minister of the Republic, Philemon Yang, that he should open a one-month investigation into what happened, that the Lions had a very poor, disgraceful, dismal, and very nauseating performance at the 2014 Brazil World Cup. Have been received with mixed feelings because a lot of Cameroonians know what the problem of our football is, that it is just few sentences, bad management from the Cameroon Football Federation, and bad management from the Ministry of Sports and Physical Education, because there are individuals in those two structures who are more interested in looking out for the parochial gains. They are looking out for the financial gain that comes with football and not actually promoting football in the country. So a lot of people, football lovers in Cameroon, the media thought that the President of the Republic should have, first of all, disbanded the Federation for a poor organization of Cameroon's show in Brazil. Because it all started in the country before they took off. Before they took off to Brazil, there was a huge problem on finances and bonuses for the Lions. And a lot of people thought that the team would qualify after beating Tunisia. We would have arranged all those things with the players. It is only in the last minute that we were supposed to take off of Brazil that players and management of the Federation and the ministry were quarreling over money. The country even went late the World Cup.
People I hear were not particularly happy with the performance of the players, and some of the players were attacked in the capital, Yaoundé. What can you tell me about this?
Yes, you know, first of all, the players, before they left for Brazil, they had held tight on the government that they must give them their bonuses for the World Cup, which is a total of 60 million francs CFA, Cameroon money. That money, Peter, was giving to the players in raw cash in Yaoundé before they even took off for Brazil. I mean, they get a huge sum of money, go to Brazil, they cannot perform and they disgrace an entire nation where you have people in the streets who cannot eat. But for within 3 weeks, people were giving 60 million and they cannot give joy to the people. So the people were very angry. I mean, these players, they come back, I mean, they don't show any remorse to the people, they don't show any remorse to the state. They are moving around, I mean, enjoying themselves, I mean, in a very lavishing manner. And so, two of them were attacked in Yaoundé. I'm talking about Stefan Dia Etundi and Benjamin Mukanjo. I mean, Benjamin Mukanjo in particular actually slips out of an irate population. I mean, I'm telling you that Stefan Tumimbia was attacked in Yaoundé by some group of guys who saw him, and then they went and said, can you give us our own part of the money from the World Cup? When he hesitated, the guys started ruffling him. So the police intervened, and they took him off. His car was smashed. You know, his car was bashed, you know. And a lot of them who came into the country after the World Cup, somewhere they could see, they have just been lying low and not making any noise.
What has been the reaction of FECAFOOT, the Federation, since they got back following the poor showing of the Indomitable Lions at the World Cup?
The officials of the Federation came into the country, Professor Joseph Owona, they have not made any public statement to Cameroonians. It is the Minister of Sports and Physical Education, Adum Gara, who went to the Parliament because the parliamentarians were very angry. They felt disgraced. They felt that the entire minister had been disgraced. And so he was answering questions to the Parliament. But even then, his answers were very uncomfortable to many parliamentarians. Instead of telling Cameroonians what happened to the World Cup in Brazil, he was instead holding on to the argument that the President of the Republic has asked for an inquiry, Cameroonians should hold on. No. So if the President does not ask for the inquiry, he, as a minister, who is supposed to have led Cameroon delegation, is not giving the people what happened. And again, in the World Cup, Cameroon was disgraced again in the fact that the minister and the federation officials were quarreling over who pays bills at hotels in Brazil. So it was a total sham for Cameroon. So Cameroonians are really, really disgusted with the way football is managed in this country, and particularly individuals who are in there. Cameroonians think that the right people are not at the right place when it comes to football management in the country. And so the entire system should be disbanded and then real and credible people brought into play.
Nana Walter Wilson is sports editor at the Post newspaper in Cameroon. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. And now Daybreak Africa sports editor Mark Ouma has the day's sports rundown. Here's Mark.
In Windhoek, the draws for the 9th edition of the Africa Women's Championships takes place in the capital, Windhoek, tomorrow, Saturday. Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, South Africa, Zambia, and hosts Namibia will be divided into two groups for the preliminary round-robin contest. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Olympic champion David Rudisha faces a stiff challenge from Ethiopian world champion Mohamed Aman, Botswana's Nigel Amos, and Sudan's Abubakar Kaki in 800 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Monaco today, Friday. On form, Jairus Kipchoge Birech seeks to fend off his Kenyan compatriots Paul Kipsiele Koech and Brimin Kiprop Kipruto to maintain his winning streak in the 3,000 meters steeplechase. Kenyan world champion Asbel Kiprop aims to win his third consecutive 1500 meters at this annual event, but could be upstaged by South African Johan Cronier or Moroccan Abdelati Igida. Botswana's inform Isaac Makwala sprints in 400 meters. Staying in Monaco, Ivory Coast's Muriel Ahore and Nigerian Blessing Okagbare clash in the women's 100 meters. South African Wenda Nell runs the 400 meter hurdles as Ugandan newcomer Winnie Nanyondo challenges Kenya's world champion Eunice Sum in 800 meters. Perhaps the most exciting clash in the women's events will be the East African showdown, where Ethiopia's Genzebe Dibaba and Almaz Ayana are pitted against Kenya's Mercy Cherono and Sally Jepkoskei Kipyego.
And that was Daybreak Africa sports editor Mark Ouma with the day sports rundown. Have a good evening, Mark. Well, folks, that's about all time will permit us for today on the sunny side of sports. I'm Peter Clotty, sitting in for the vacationing Sunny Young. Back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, Peter. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And today, Peter has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
In our feature segment, we're going to hear about a major star of the Soukous music, that is the Congolese pop music rooted in rumba. And next, South Sudanese youth calling for a ban on tribal marks. They say the practice is irrelevant to the new generation. But first, some music. Here is Tikenja Fakole from Ivory Coast with African Revolution.
Thank you.
Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education. We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be black people education.
Go to school, brother, and learn what they are doing. It will open your eyes to the people's situation. Go to school, my brother. I said go to school. You will understand very soon all the problems of your nation.
We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education.
In your mind, brother, there is the power to change the world. This understanding will help to make a better place. In your hands, brother, there is the key to this continent. And if you don't unlock it soon, it will be lost to the government.
With African Revolution.
Well, today we're going to hear about a major star of Soukous music, the Congolese pop music rooted in rumba. The star is Marie Josie of the DRC of the Congo, also known by fans as Maje Trant. VOA's Rousne Muntu is the host of his own music show in French on many FM stations in Africa. Lenore Madu asked to tell him more about his popular rising star.
Tell us about Marie-Josée Mégétrante.
Marie-Josée Mégétrante, Lenore, used to be one of the lead singer in the group Mamou National. The leader, the owner of the band is Tshala Moana, known all over
She's
Africa.
She's very well known.
Right?
Soukous.
Yes. And Mutuashi, the yes. belly dance from...
Absolutely.
From,
I remember those days.
You remember those
yes,
days?
Yes, yes.
Exactly. So Mégétrante was one of... Mégé 30, it was one of the her lead singer, but... You know, it didn't work out for her, and she just left the team to start, I mean, the band, to start her own band.
So how is her career doing?
Her career is doing great, and the video we're about to watch, actually, you can tell that it's going great because she's actually featuring with Fally Ipupa, who's well-known all over Africa
absolutely,
right now.
Absolutely,
right? So, you know, she's doing great.
Okay, great. Yeah. So let's take a look, and we'll be right back.
Great. J'ai 30.
Fally qui coupe à 10 cap la merveille.
Chabonne.
Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne. Chabonne.
alaka ba medecin ba ye ebele na zongi si bango na bokubika
misisa nange kanga mi ba crampe ba kine ba ye ebele yo na kokwanza ya pamba osoulage nga
possible ikembe ozobetela nga c'est pas possible ezobinisa nga outre mesure
Let me start by saying her voice is impressive,
isn't it?
Yes, beautiful.
And Lenore, she used to actually sing for a choir in church when she was younger, and that's how she was discovered by Chala Moana to start doing this actually professionally.
So how long has she been singing, really?
She's been singing since she was 10 years old. But professionally, it's only probably, well, not only, but about 6 years.
And the duo with Fally Ipupa, that's a great touch there.
It was a great touch, and this was the first time she actually does this featuring with Fally Ipupa. And it was great, because you know Fally has a great voice, a male voice, and that was a great combination. And this actual video, this actual song, is all over Kinshasa and Brazzaville.
So quickly, what do you see in the future for her?
For her, I see the next Chala Moana. The way we knew Chala Moana, that's how this girl, this young
girl,
would
be. Does she dance like Chala Moana?
Oh my God, she danced just like, well, okay. Next time I'll bring you the video.
That was VOA Music host Roger Rouse Muntu speaking with reporter Lenore Madu about Suscous singer Marie Jose.
Some South Sudanese youth are calling for a ban on tribal marks, saying the practice is irrelevant to the new generation. They also say the marks are a hindrance to national unity. The call follows a recent national workshop on peace and reconciliation for more than 50 youth from across the country. For VOA, Mugume Davis Rawakarinji has more from Juba.
Tribal marks are a common cultural practice among South Sudanese who use it as a rite of passage into adulthood. The marks vary from one community to another and are usually inscribed on parts of the body, often the forehead. But young people like 20-year-old Gwak Philip Aleu from Western Bahar Ghazal State say armed combatants are using the culture marks as a way to single out tribal identities of community members who are their enemies.
There are very many that have been identified in that way because in the war-affected areas like in Malakal and Bentiu, they were using those bases. You see, even in Juba here, some cases were seen in that similar scenario where they find they know that your marks are the ones of the Nuer, and then it's the Dinka that has come, or a soldier is a Dinka whose parents have been killed in Malakal, then he takes a revenge.
Aleu says the practice is outdated and should end.
With the current civilization, it doesn't look well, even if you go outside South Sudan. Some people who do not have never seen such kind of marks. They begin looking at you as a strange person. Instead of trying to listen to what you are saying, they are trying to look at the marks and how they were. So your points of view will not be taken the way you wanted them to be.
Aleu realizes that most older people will not embrace the idea of ending this centuries-old cultural practice. And 70-year-old John Booth Yol is one of them.
These identification marks have always made a man very brave. When you have them, you cannot fear an enemy. You can fight as a man.
62-year-old Dak Wang from Akobo County in Jonglei State also insists that tribal marks are an important part of South Sudanese culture and should continue.
This is our heritage that was introduced many years ago. The tribal marks are part of our customary law that governs the people and helps in identifying someone who has been killed for compensation. You cannot ban them.
John Grace was elected by her colleagues to chair the youth wing at the National Platform for Peace and Reconciliation. Her job involves educating young people about the negative effects of tribal marks. She says her group will soon start a media campaign to gain momentum for abolishing tribal marks.
In other tribes or in other people's culture, it is very important to them. But also we need to tell them the disadvantages of these marks in some extent if they could really really realize that this having mugs sometimes may cause problem, they should really look into some ways of how to stop it.
Grace says the bottom line is encouraging the nation's youth to help restore peace in their country in any way they can, which she believes includes ending the practice of culture marks. For VOA News, I am Ogumedes Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Advancing the full participation of women and girls in the political, economic, and social realms is a key goal of U.S. foreign policy. The United States has worked with partners all over the world to increase women's participation in civil society and in local and national governments. We have encouraged other governments to remove legislative and cultural barriers that lock women out of the formal economy, because no state can prosper if half of its people cannot participate. And we have emphasized the necessity of including women's perspectives in all aspects of peacemaking, peacekeeping, and peacebuilding. Nonetheless, gender discrimination, inequality, and violence against girls and women persist in every country around the globe. Women and girls are disproportionately affected by poverty and have limited access to educational opportunities, land and property ownership, and financial services. Women's participation in politics and civil society is limited, often by law. Adolescent girls in developing countries face particular challenges, including poorer educational outcomes, gender-based violence, traditional harmful practices such as early and forced marriage, and female genital mutilation or cutting, and higher vulnerability to disease and infections such as HIV. That is why, in early July, Secretary of State John Kerry directed all State Department bureaus and embassies to increase efforts to promote gender equality and advance the status of women and girls. This includes promoting women's economic and political participation by addressing discrimination, fostering entrepreneurship and leadership, supporting U.S. initiatives to prevent gender-based violence, empowering girls, and by advocating on the international stage for issues affecting women and girls. The United States continues to support measures aimed at correcting the underlying injustice of gender inequality and discrimination, said Daniel Baer, U.S. Ambassador to the OSCE Permanent Council in Vienna. We remain committed to unlocking the power and potential for progress that women and girls represent around the world. The barriers that bar the full participation of women in the economic, social, and political lives of their countries, be they overt or concealed, written or unwritten, must be demolished in order to maximize the peace and prosperity of all nations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.